Hey everyone, welcome to a new episode of the Darius Farou Show. Today I am joined by Vitaly Katsanelson. He is an investor and an author. Welcome to the show.
Darius, thank you. My pleasure.
So I've read your latest book called Soul in the Game, and I really like that title. It really speaks to me, and there are a lot of things that I'd love to talk to you about, particularly you as an investor, but also as a philosopher that you are right now, which is this book. It's more also philosophy about life. But I really want to start off with a topic that you and I are both inspired by, and that is Stoicism. Mm-hmm. So I remember really clearly the moment that I figured out or that I discovered Stoicism, and I still remember what that period was like in my life. How was that for you when you discovered it? How did that happen?
Well, let me flip this question to you. What was your moment? I'm curious.
You're my guest, right?
I want to know, but I'll give you.
Yeah, well, that's cool. I like it. So, for me, this was around 2014, 2015, and at the time I was living in London, and I was working at the IT research firm Gartner, and my grandmother passed away, and I had a really close relationship with my grandmother, and around that time I started to look for some answers because I wasn't really satisfied with my career at the time. And I had read about Stoicism first in Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek. And at the time when I read it for the first time, it didn't really resonate with me, but as I went through this loss, somehow I was reminded by Stoicism, and then I started to read the original works from Seneca and Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus, and Epictetus was really my favorite. And then a lot of things started to fall into its place, because it wasn't really that it changed my perspective, but it was like, oh, these guys are talking about a lot of things that I have always felt, but they are so good at formulating it, and it gives you a system to operate, and I'm a practical guy, so I really loved that type of thinking and putting everything together. So that's how it, went for me.
So let me start with a quote by Elon Musk. I read this quote a few days ago and it really stuck with me. He says, "Who wrote the software running in your head? Are you sure you actually want it there?" And that sums up what Stoic philosophy is for me. It means to me, but I'll get to that in a second. But let me first tell you what triggered my interest in Stoic philosophy. Actually, there's a quote by Epictetus, and I'm going to butcher it, but where he says, some things are up to us, a lot of things aren't. Okay. And what you learn, there are very few things that are up to us. It's really our values. It's how we behave. Okay. It's, you know, how we react to things. Everything else is not up to us. It's not up to you if you are driving to work and you encounter a red light on every stop. It's not up to you if your coworkers are, rude to you. It's not up to you if your grandma dies. It really isn't. So, but what's up to you is how you process it. So that quote really triggered my interest in Stoic philosophy. And the way I look at Stoic philosophy, it's an operating system for life. When we are born, and this is why I used the Musk quote, when we are born, we basically have hardware and software. And the software is, the software is fairly blank. And then over time, this software, the way we behave is written to us by our parents, by our friends, by circumstances, by books we read. And a lot of times it's kind of ad hoc pieces of software that don't not necessarily work well with each other, just a lot of different programs. And what Stoic philosophy is to me is the, it's an operating system, a well-designed operating system that allows me to go through life by minimizing, and where it minimizes the negativity, the negative volatility in my life. And by doing that, it actually maximizes positive things in my life.
Yeah, I think that's a great description of what Stoicism is and how you can apply it. And what was that time when you learned about the philosophy? Was there anything that you were going through in particular? Or because I often, when I speak to people, you know, I think the biggest change often comes from pain. Was there anything?
Not, it could have been, but not just not this time around. I mean, I wish I learned it when I was truly in pain. No, it was happened during the pandemic, and the pandemic was painful to a lot of people. It wasn't really painful to me, in the sense that I haven't really had anybody who, you know, who was close to me get sick. My job was not really jeopardized by the pandemic because, you know, everybody in my office just started to work from home. So I wasn't really impacted by pandemic that much. But it just, for some reason at that point in time, I was ready. By the way, if I read this quote, you know, 3 years before or a year after, it could have just, you know, I could have completely missed it. It just,
yeah, exactly.
At that point in time, I was ready for it.
Yeah, it's all about timing, right? Like when I read about it the first time, it didn't really resonate with me. And when I was going through a tough time, it was really the moment for me to dig deeper and also that it really finally clicked.
Yes.
And during those moments, I just got super excited about it and started reading all of the original works, which is, I think, the best way to learn about the philosophy. You know, we all interpret it in our own way. And in your book, I've read about your interpretation, and everybody interprets it in a different way. And then I think, to me, that's the best way to go about it, to read a philosophy and kind of make it your own. I think this is something that either Seneca or Epictetus said, that at some point you have to become a philosopher yourself as well. Because what's the point of all only just consuming and following others? At some point you want to do things your own way. And I think that's the ultimate goal of philosophy and also Stoicism.
Well, I think also Stoic philosophy, I think I would rename it a little bit. In fact, I would call it Stoic practice.
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, philosophy, you know, sounds, you know, make it sound very intimidating, right? Yeah. Because you visualize all these quotes that make a little sense to us by a lot of dead people. But Stoic philosophy, it is 2,000 years old. So it is by dead people, but it's not very intimidating. But more importantly, it's a practice, in the sense that you knowing, there's a great saying, I think it's goes in the category of Chinese proverbs, because we don't know the origin of it. But knowing and not doing is not knowing. Meaning that if you know something but you don't practice it, like when it applies to Stoic philosophy, when you know about Stoic philosophy and you don't practice it, it's almost like if you didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
And Stoic philosophy requires practice, because what you do, you're trying to reprogram your operating system that has been written for decades.
Yeah.
And to do this, you just have to do it, practice it, you know, on a daily basis. And you fail plenty, and that's okay. As long as you get up, when you fail, you get up and, you know, learn from your mistakes and keep going forward.
Yeah, this is a great point, and that brings me to the next topic that I'd love to talk to you about is your upbringing, where you come from, because I can relate to that as well. For me, first generation immigrant in the Netherlands. My family is originally from Iran. And also learning certain habits and thinking systems and patterns growing up, which you talked about. And by the way, when he was talking about Stoicism, it reminded me of what Seneca said, is it's not about being perfect, right? It's not about Stoicism. It's not about setting ideals and always being perfect. It's about striving to be perfect. Because if you mess up, you make a mistake, the next moment is a new moment to strive for being perfect. But it's an ideal that no one will ever accomplish. But that's not the goal. The goal is just to work towards it. Right, and that's what always attracted me the most, because academics and people who are very uptight and very small-minded, they think you have to do things a certain way, and if you don't do that, then you fail. But Stoicism is actually also a very comforting philosophy, where they say, well, you screw up, okay, that's fine, just try again.
Seneca has this concept that I really, really love. Each day is a separate life, which allows you to screw up. At the end of the day, you look at your day and you say, did I live up to my expectations? And if you didn't, you learn, and then you have a next day, tomorrow. This is why I never set kind of New Year resolutions. Because usually, everybody sets them in February and January, signs up for health clubs, and then in February they forget about it. So that's why I just have a kind of daily resolutions.
Yeah, that's to me also the best way to live, just to make it a lifestyle. So let's go back. Let's go back to your formative years. So you came from Russia to the United States. How did that move happen?
Yeah. So I used to say, I was born, kind of that I came from Russia. Now I'm so embarrassed for Russia that I say I came from USSR.
It was at the time, right?
Yeah. Well, it was at the time, but now, I used to be proud that I was born in Russia. Now I'm embarrassed by this country. So I'm, but that's a different topic. Mm-hmm. So I was born. I was born in Russia, and I lived there until 1991. So I came to the United States when I was 18 years old, and so I grew up in this town, Murmansk. And if you look at the map of Russia, and you look left, and go up a lot, as you go above the Arctic Circle, right by Norway, that's where Murmansk is. So it's a very cold place, very little sunlight, very little vegetation. And you would think it would be a miserable place to grow up. But here's the interesting part. I did not know any better. And I thought that was normal. And so I loved it. I had I had loving parents, good childhood. I would argue that growing up in Russia was my secret weapon when I came to United States, because I think I appreciated this country so much more than people who were born here. Because a lot of times people who are born in this country, just the same way I was taking like all the adversity I went through for granted, they take all the goodness that this country has to offer for granted as well. And when I went from Russia to United States, that contrast between where I came from and what the United States has to offer was so evident to me. And I think that kind of lights the fuel under you and makes you work harder than others, so I look at it as I have a chapter in the book called Born in Russia, Made in America. That's kind of how I look at myself.
Well, you can certainly see the values right? In your philosophy, in your book as well, and I can relate to that as a lot, right? Because, you know, coming from where I come from, and moving to the West, and the Netherlands and the United States are very similar in ideals and values and you know, culture.
Yeah.
So I can really relate to that, and it has really shaped my thinking and you know, goals. And also, I always kind of felt like kind of escaped my fate, you know, because if I would stay there,
oh, absolutely,
right, I would not be in this position at all. And that's something that I think about often. It makes me very grateful.
Think about this. If I like, you know, if I stayed in Russia today, my 21-year-old son could have been conscripted into the, you know, Russian army to find, you know, to fight in Ukraine. So I'm so lucky that I'm not in Russia.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think we all need to find some type of gratitude practice to remind ourselves that that we are lucky. And even, you know, if you don't have these types of stories, there is something to find in your story that is worth being grateful for. So,
actually, can I give you an example? Actually, let me. Yeah. So, this is my son was flying from Amsterdam to Denver, and I think he was flying through Frankfurt, and he came to Frankfurt, and he arrived to Frankfurt. His flight was delayed. He missed his flight. He ended up staying overnight. And my son is 6'3" or 6'4". He's very tall. And suddenly his, you know, kind of economy plus seats were not available. And for I don't know, 10 hours, he had to be, you know, sitting in a kind of in a normal seat. And, you know, he's just too big for it. And he calls me right before the flight and says, "Dad, this is the worst day in my life." You know, like, well, I just realized he was probably very emotional, exhausted, etc. And I said, "I wish this was the worst day of your life." Okay. And I think imagining, it's very important. This, you know, Stoics have this concept of negative visualization. Yeah. This concept is so important because it allows us to frame whatever is happening to us in a way that it doesn't bother. It's a reframe it so it doesn't bother us as much as we allow it to bother us. I could have, you know, framed to my son that 40 years ago it would take you, I don't know, 2 weeks to, you know, if you want to take a trip to Denver, or 2 or 3 weeks, if you want to take a Denver to from Amsterdam, it would take you 3 weeks through, you know, take a boat, and then when you arrive to New York, and then you would, I don't know, I'm not even sure how you get from New York to Denver, but at the time, but that's it. Yeah. So,
yeah, so but at that time, he's like getting pissed, right? Just me.
Exactly. So it could have been so much worse. But also, like, I'll give you another example. And this is, I catch myself. Remember, that's why I'm saying Stoicism is a practice. We went to a resort in Mexico, and we booked an Ocean View Hotel, and we arrived there, and it's not available. And the old version of me would be very upset about this. But the new version of me kind of, I was thinking, well, it could have been so much worse. It could have been that, you know, we could have arrived and they could have had, you know, what if they had no reservation? You know, they didn't have a reservation. Or what if I didn't live in the United States, but I lived in Russia or Ukraine at this time, you know, and there was a bombing going on. So all the problems I have are they really problems? So I'm going to sleep in a room that's still nice, air-conditioned room. It's just not going to have an ocean view.
Yeah, this is an exercise that Sam Harris also shares on his Waking Up app.
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually inspired by both, you know, Stoicism, but also by Eastern philosophy. I love Buddhism and mindfulness because they basically focus to achieve the same thing, which is tranquility and inner peace. But you know, the Eastern philosophy focus more on or the has a different vehicle, meditation, and the Stoics just do it through talking to themselves and arguing with themselves or journaling and not so much meditation. But one thing we can all meditate on is that the things that did not happen to us, right? Because very straightforward exercise is to be grateful for what you have. But what I loved about this, you know, Sam Harris thing that he talked about on his app was he takes the time to think about the things that have not happened to him, like diseases or common things that happen to a lot of people, or, you know, being born in the U.S. in his case, or you know, absolutely. Like all, there's so many things that you can think of that millions, or in some cases even billions of people are going through, which are not good, you know. And thinking about those things, I think, is a very helpful exercise.
There is you made some interesting points. I want to kind of double click on them. Number one, mindfulness. And I would argue meditation is incredibly important. And there are many benefits, but the one I want to kind of zoom in on is the kind of if you combine it with Stoicism, it becomes very powerful.
Yeah.
Because what meditation allows you to do is observe your own thoughts. Okay. And allows you to kind of be almost like an outsider to your own thoughts. And by doing that, you are able to kind of step in. And when you are, when you feel like the anger coming, and this, you know, or when you are, you feel that, like it allows you to reframe. It gives you this moment to step in and reframe what could have been a negative thought into positive thought or neutral thought, which I think is incredibly important. So it's this combination of meditation and Stoicism. I find to be like, you know, I think to practice Stoicism, you almost need to meditate just so you can buy this second or two or half a second to reframe things.
Yeah.
And over time, it will become your kind of innate behavior. If you do this enough,
exactly,
then you'll reprogram yourself to look at things from a kind of a more neutral perspective. Because a lot of times, if you just take things that are really not negative, they're just, you know, they're really just neutral, and turn it into negative, and that causes a lot of pain.
Yeah, I've meditated relatively consistently for, I would say, about 3 to 4 years. And over the last, I would say, year and a half or so, I haven't really meditated, and I haven't had that urgency or that feeling to meditate, because that skill that you just described of being aware of my thoughts has been, you know, strengthened
programmed
in my mind. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean I will never meditate again, because just like any skill, you need to keep it up. But I really see the benefits of it in my daily life. It's just like investing, right? You invest for years and years and years in some cases, and you don't see much return. And then at some point, you reach a point where the growth is way beyond your expectations, and it changes, and it can be life-changing, right? And I feel that is the power of meditation, or can be the power of meditation, but also practicing Stoicism. You know, it takes years to really take those concepts and make them your own and live by them. Because initially you just read them and you're like, oh, sounds great. Then you just get on with your life and you fall for the same traps. But that's just repetition, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that aspect of philosophy and, you know, Stoicism and everything. So how did you get into investing?
So today I run an investment firm, IMA. I'm a CEO of a value investment firm in Denver. And what we do, we basically help high net worth clients to preserve and grow their nest egg, for the most part. But I got it in my early 20s when I went to college. I dated 6 or 7 different majors. At some point I wanted to become a lawyer, then I wanted to become a manager, different majors, computer science. And then then 2 things happened. I got a job with an investment firm, but they hired me because I was good with computers. And at the same time, I took finance classes, which were prerequisite to business degree at CU Denver. And the combination, this was luck, because taking these finance classes and then bringing this knowledge and talking to the folks who work for this investment firm really sparked my interest in finance and investing. And then over time, I realized that I'm not just interested in investing, I'm interested in value investing, which is its own kind of philosophy, investment philosophy. And I was lucky in this way that I kind of discovered what I love doing relatively early in my life. So I had a combination of focus and passion. When you have focus and passion, it's very difficult not to do well.
Yeah. And I can I assume also that you were driven by the urge to be financially secure, or was it purely interest, and did you have the belief, well, I can get rich as a lawyer or anything else as well, and you chose investing because you really were interested in it?
Yeah, so this is the assumption you're making is the very common assumption, but I was not driven by money. It's kind of interesting.
I find that really hard to believe as an immigrant. I've never met an immigrant who was not driven by money. So I don't buy that.
I really liked investing. I at the time I did not know why. Today I can tell you why, because investing provides this intellectual riddle.
Yes.
You get to learn a lot, and I always like learning new things. But I didn't want to get into profession. When I was choosing profession, either one of them would make me a good amount of money.
Yeah.
It wasn't because, I wanted to become wealthy. This is why I was going to invest in. I just literally, at the time I was just, I really like that. I think it was very interesting to me. So today people look at me and say, you must love money because this is what you do for a living. And for me, an artist, you don't have to be in love with a stone when you make statues, for me, money is just ingredients, from which, wealth my clients has created. And I'm not driven by money at all. So that's not a drive at all.
Yeah. It's a really common trait of, the most successful investors, that the initial, attraction, for most of them has been money, even for Warren Buffett, where he just clearly said, when I was young, I just wanted to get rich. But the moment that you get into it, the intellectual challenge takes over, and then you figure out, I've been living in the same house for 50 years and I drive the same car. I don't really care about the money. And that's the beauty of it.
Yeah. So I think what happened to me, I'm not going to generalize for other people, is that after I get to certain financial independence, at that point money stopped, financial security, money stopped being a motivator. So it's just because we live a very modest lifestyle. I don't receive that much enjoyment from material things. Therefore, I wake up in the morning because I love creating things. I love learning new things. And So money is kind of, for me, is kind of, you know, the second or third or fourth thing, you know, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. That's I think pretty common for most folks. When you get there, then there needs to be something more meaningful, and otherwise, you know, we get on that hedonic treadmill, which is never satisfying.
That's right.
Yeah. So, how did you start your own firm?
Well, I didn't start it. I joined IMA in 1997, and over time, I joined as an analyst. I became portfolio manager, then a CIO, and then I brought out my partner, and now I'm a CEO of the firm. And it's in all fairness, this is the firm today is very different than it was, you know, 10, 15 years ago, or when I joined the firm. There's a lot more of my DNA and my thinking is kind of embedded in the firm than it was, you know, 15 years ago.
So what do you mean by that?
So companies, when companies are formed, they basically usually reflect the values of the founder. And even though I was not a founder of the firm, my ex-partner Mike allowed me, when I started running the firm, to kind of reshape it to reflect my values. Mm. So, today IMA is completely associated with me, which is a good and bad from a business perspective. Our investment philosophy is completely been formed by me. Mike has taught me a lot. My ex-partner Mike, the founder of IMA, has taught me a lot. But I just took what he taught me and made it my own.
Just like the philosophy stuff we were talking about, like Seneca.
Exactly. It has to, because anything you do has to fit you. It has to click with your personality, it has to fit your IQ and your EQ at the same time. So, yes.
Yeah, and it also takes a real philosopher or a confident person to say that or provide that opportunity.
And I think Mike had always had a belief in me.
Yeah,
and so he was comfortable doing it, which is I admire him a lot for that, for many other things, but that as well.
Yeah, I think that's really really a beautiful thing to. Let someone take over and really, do their own thing truly without pulling the strings. And that's a very honorable thing.
Yeah.
Honorable thing to do. So, you built out the firm and then at some point you think, oh, I need to write a book. Or you also have a blog and a newsletter. Right.
Well, in all fairness, this is my third book.
Yeah,
I wrote two investment books.
Yeah, but I like a book about philosophy and meaning.
Yeah, no. Yeah. So my point is that I wrote two investment books, one in 2007, another in 2010, and The Soul in the Game, The Art of Meaningful Life, is really a book about investing in your life. So you could argue it's another investment book, except instead of investing in stocks, you invest in yourself. And but took a lot of courage to write this book. Let me tell you why. Because my previous books, you would argue that I had a pedigree to write those books. I have a master's have an undergraduate and graduate degrees in finance. I'm a chartered financial analyst. I managed money for a long time before I wrote those books. So there was a lot of practical experience that went into writing them. But I did not major in liberal arts, or I did not study Stoics for decades. In the book I write about classical music, I can't even play an instrument. I give a parenting advice, and I would, you know, in the book, and I am as qualified to give this, you know, this advice as any parent, you know. So this book took courage because I'm not really qualified to dispense any advice. And by the way, I try not to. What I try to do is to show how I do those things. And some of them will click with you and some of them won't. And the good thing about this book, there are 75 chapters and they're all different. And that if you, when you read the book, if you get one or two things out of the book, that's already a victory. I think there's a good chance that people get more than one thing out of this book.
Yeah. Yeah. That's also how I usually read a book, is my goal is just to get at least one idea. And when that happens, I really feel good about the time investment that I made. And by flipping that, by, you know, writing it in a way that your goal is that the reader walks away with at least one thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's also how I write my books. And it really helps me to focus on just providing as much value as I can to to readers. So what is, for example, just one thing that you would like people to walk away with, or maybe a reader who has reached out to you, or do you have a story that comes to mind for something that somebody picked up, or you want people, obviously you don't want, you just shared that you write how you do things, but what's something that comes to mind?
It's kind of interesting. One thing I learned is that what is dear to me as a writer often is not dear to my readers. Sometimes I would write these articles and I learned so much through writing this article. That's why that article becomes dear to me. And when I share this with my readers, I get almost no feedback because it didn't click with them. I think one of my favorite chapters, and I think that's because that's the one I learned the most of from, is that where I talk about the concept of art and craft. So there is a story that, you know, accompanies this chapter. So my brother, my son, and I were in Venice, and we went to a Murano factory in Venice where they make glass. And we see this, you know, and there was a demonstration. So this guy takes a bulb of kind of hot glass, takes triceps, and literally in a matter of 30 seconds to a minute, he makes a horse out of it, like a glass horse, which looks like a horse. And by the way, just if you go on YouTube and you just type horse Murano factory, you'll see a similar video, you know, what we observe. And we were shocked by that. And my brother, my son, and I had plenty of time just to walk in Venice and think about things and, you know, discuss things. And we were discussing if this horse is art or craft. And this was an interesting discussion. And then we would, you know, walk by the streets of Venice, and we would look at the storefronts, and we see a whole bunch of these horses that look just identical to the one we saw. And we kind of came to the conclusion maybe it wasn't art, but it was craft. And then I realized that it's so subjective what art and craft is. And if it touches you, it's art. If it doesn't, it's craft. However, then I had an interesting insight. What's really important is not is it art or craft, but is the, when you are creating it, when you now, like when you look at this person who created this horse, was that an art or craft for him? And this is where it gets interesting, because imagine this guy when he started, to study, you know, how to do things out of hot glass. Everything he did was almost all art, because every time he sat down in front of this hot bulb of glass, he did not know how it's going to turn out. But after he made his, you know, 300 horses, 301st horse had a lot less art and more craft, because there was less there was less risk in it. There was, you know, he already knew how it's going to look like, right? So the less uncertainty. So anything we do, if we do this enough, and let's say there's very little variability in it, over, you know, it's going to start out as art, and over time it's become craft. And the more, and by the way, to create art, you need to have both. You need to have some craft. But if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, you, at some point in time, you will squeeze out all the art out of it, and all that you're going to have left is craft. So what, therefore, what's important to do in life is introduce new elements, new things that are, that will keep you curious, keep coming back to this. And as a writer, like you could argue that after writing for decades, for more than a decade about investing, that's why I wrote about life, because there was more art in it for me. And where investing became, writing about investing just had a lot more craft in it. And if you, and again, I'm, if you're a creative person, okay, and I'm just, and you only have craft in your life, most likely you're going to have a very miserable existence. Again, if you're, some people, all they want is predictability and they don't want uncertainty. Those are, and again, I'm generalizing. Those people are usually not creative, which is fine. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that. But you, if you are a creative person and all you have is craft, you need to change things up. And I, like in the book, I use example of Claude Monet, where he rented an apartment in Rouen, France, and for 6 months he painted the Rouen Cathedral. And if you know, and there is, this is why when you go to all these museums, you always see the cathedral, Rouen Cathedral, because he painted over 30 paintings. What Manet was doing, he was studying light. He found that this cathedral looks, even though the architecture doesn't change, the light, which is so fickle, and it's a, and it changes at time of the year, time of the day, etc. That's, you know, he was studying how to paint it. And for 6 months, every single day, there was something different. And so he painted it for 6 months. And he finished a lot of the paintings in his studio, you know, years later. And then he, after he was done with Rouen Cathedral, he went to paint haystacks. Actually, I'm lying a little bit because I think he did haystacks before that, but you know, but it still makes a good story.
Yeah, it's funny. After reading the book, I made a couple of notes, and the thing that I really wanted to talk about was the importance of repetition. I wrote this down. It was kind of the chapter that you were referring to, where my takeaway was like repetition is really an important aspect of living a meaningful life. Because if you only have art and you never repeat that art, and you jump from one thing to the other, so, oh, I like painting, I like writing, I like making movies, I like investing, I like doing this and that, right? And you're all over the place and you never perform any repetition. Then you never get to that point of having the art and the craft, and then doing something to create something or give value or meaning to the world, where kind of others can enjoy it or whatever it is. And that's, I think, for me also, is where the meaning comes into play. It's like, okay, when I write something for myself, it's good. I feel good. You know, when I write in my journal, I feel better and I improve my focus or whatever it is. But when I write an article about a topic that people are really interested in or resonates with readers, and I get feedback on that and people tell me, oh, this changed my perspective, or I love this, whatever. Those two things come together and I feel meaningful.
No, I think it's a very tricky, so this is important. It's a very tricky balance. You need to find the balance between, you don't want to have too much art and you don't want to have too much craft. So you need to find a balance where you, over time, your skills improve. Okay. So you have more craft, you know, but you still have, so, and then you achieve it through repetition. But at the same time, can you just imagine all your life making this horse? Like if you were that art, you know, making this horse all your life, at some point there's absolutely no art left, all is craft, and you come to work and all you're trying to do maybe is just, if you made 50 horses yesterday, you want to try to make 51 today. That's it. And, you know, that's, and then you reach your kind of, yeah, but that's.
Yeah. But there, like, for example, I know a tattoo artist, and I have tattoos, and when I got my rose tattoo as part of a larger piece, I said, "Hey, you must have gotten crazy of doing roses, right? You've done probably thousands of them in your career." Kind of a little bit similar as the horse guy, right? Doing the same thing. But what he said to me is that he never gets bored by doing roses, even though they are always pretty much the same. What he loves is that he creates the art on a person's body and it becomes meaningful for that person. So in there are cases where you could do the exact same thing, but it still has meaning.
I think it's possible. So this is this is a very tricky discussion. Let me explain you why. Because I want to have a life where I'm a net positive to other people. So that's important to me. And that's what you just described that artists do.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it has to be, that has to be byproduct of something that is interesting to me. And I know if, let's say I keep making these roses and people love them, but at some point I get bored by that, even though it's still not, like, let's say it continues to be not positive to other people, I'd be miserable. So you need to find, like, it's a, I bet this artist, if he just, all he did, I'm sure he paints
more. Yeah, he does other things. Well. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If all he did, so there's plenty of things in between.
Yeah.
But no,
enough variety in his life.
Exactly.
In his art,
if he only did roses,
there's no variety.
So it's kind of interesting. So for me, to have a meaningful life, you need to have three things. You need to have good relationships, meaningful relationships with your friends, family. That's number one. Number two, you need to have enough creativity, kind of this right balance between art and craft in your life. And number three, you need to be net positive to society. Now, if one room is missing, then this whole thing collapses for me. So in other words, if I only have craft, so there's no creativity, like the way we just discussed, then the whole art, the whole not positive part loses its meaning as well.
Yeah. And how do you feel if there is a moment that is missing? What can you describe the emotion? Maybe people can relate to the feeling.
Well, I've been lucky that I've been lucky that I managed to maintain this balance throughout my life. So I don't think I struggled much with that. And here's the interesting part. I don't think I did it mindfully. It just happened. I was lucky. So now, like what I told you now, I don't think I even had this framework 10 years ago.
Did it naturally or through, things.
I was
that,
lucky.
Yeah.
I didn't come to it mindfully. I just kind of stumbled into it.
Yeah. It's like, sometimes you read these or you see these books of habits of successful people or whatever it is. And they come from studying people who do those things naturally, right? So there are people who have certain things, they do them, and maybe they're not really defined or in their mind, but they do them. And then, you know, somebody goes and kind of puts everything together and then describes it, which I always find interesting, because these things come from somewhere. It's not like the author made them up or whatever, you know, they saw, they observed them.
I think you get this, like, you know, like, you know, discuss this, and it sounds like I arrived to these things, you know, through a lot of it through retrospection. In other words, I just looked and thought about it, but I would not have arrived to it if I did not write every day, 2 hours a day, almost every day of the year.
Yeah.
That's how I was able to recognize it, because I spend, you know, just 2 hours a day writing. It's probably, and I would argue, writing is one of the most important things that has happened to me as a human being, not just professionally, same. But as, you know, as a human being. Yeah.
Yeah. Same. I think, you know, when people make these generalized statements of, you know, everybody should get enough sleep, eat a healthy diet, and work out, I think we should add writing or journaling to it as well, because it's such a great tool to, you know, learn about yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And translate your thoughts into words, which is something, you know, before I did that, I never really thought of it. But now that I've, you know, doing it, because the thoughts are always abstract, and that process of translating my thoughts into words is one of the most helpful things, and also things that I enjoy the most of normal day.
Yeah, I think that is such a great point, because what happens a lot of times, like this happens to me as an investor, my analyst brings me an idea, and I have an innate response, like positive or negative, and at the time I can't explain it. And then what I have to do, I have to sit down and write about it, or I have to go for a walk and think about it, you know, and then I can verbalize where it's coming from. And I think it's just, you know, when you do something long enough, there's a pattern, you know, you basically add a lot of data to subconscious. And on the subconscious level, like, you know, when, you know, he brings me an idea, my subconscious mind sees a pattern. And this is why, you know, I have positive and negative response to it. And then only after I spend some time thinking about it, I can verbalize it.
And do you have a process for doing this?
You know, I talk about, you know, the importance of meditation and being mindful. I think I just try to observe that, you know, like when he brings me an idea, and now I understand that I tell him, listen, my first reaction is negative. Mm-hmm. I can't verbalize it yet. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, sometime I come back, you know, maybe next day or a few days later, I come back to him and say, here's why. This is important. Now that I can put it in sentences, we can have a discussion about it. Mm. And then, by the way, and I can, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there is a, you know, I could be wrong about this as well. So, then we can have a conversation about it. Mm. Kind of get into a scientist mode. Yeah.
Do you write it down before when you sit down to think, or do you just sit and try to formulate your thoughts and try to make the abstract or the initial thoughts more clear to yourself?
It depends. This is where it gets a little bit random, because it depends what I'm working on at this point in time. Yeah. If I'm working on a letter to clients and I have to do, you know, it's, I wish I could say I was very methodical about this. But I just kind of, 2 hours a day I write, and whatever whatever I choose, it seems to be important to me at that point in time. Mm-hmm. That's what I work on. A lot of, by the way, sometimes I work on two or three articles at a time.
Yeah. For me, journaling and thinking is also a fluid process. There's no real structure to it, because mm-hmm. the reason that I'm asking is that I know a lot of my readers and listeners are often interested in hearing how people journal or how people translate their thoughts into sentences or on paper. Yeah. And what I found is that it's different for everybody, every person. It really depends on how you think and how you're, how you look at the world and, your personality. And it's something that I prefer not to think too much about, because then you can kind of limit yourself,
So it's a, I wish I journaled more, and this is one of the goals I have, but I kind of struggle with journaling for a different reason. I think I've journaled for maybe a period of time, maybe for a few months, but the reason it was a struggle for me, because it conflicted with my writing routine. Mm. Because the writer in me would take over. Yeah. And actually, it happened. Actually, sometimes my journaling turned into articles. Mm. So what I need to do, because I write in the morning, every morning, maybe I should journal at night, kind of for 10, 15 minutes in the evening. Though I find that it's very difficult. Once I'm in front of the computer with word processor and my headphones on, it's like I'm not the writer takes over and journaling turns into something else. But here's the thing: if you don't write, most people don't do what I do.
Yeah.
Then they should they create a space in their life and journal. I think part of me wishes I did this. I think I just write so much that it doesn't fit well into my routines.
Yeah, I can see that trade-off, because in that same time, you could maybe write half of an article or an article that you could potentially share.
My journaling spills into an article itself. So it's again,
that you kind of give it a purpose. And for me, when I really started to get serious about journaling, I've been doing it consistently now for 7 years. And the moment that I started doing it consistently was when I saw a practical application to journaling, which the way that I use it is like I use the app called Day One. Mm-hmm. And it's just dedicated to journaling. And I usually do it to kind of look at my own behavior and things that happened in the past. So, for mm-hmm. example, mm-hmm. Last year I noticed I had some stomach problems more often. And in my mind, I was like, well, I didn't have... like, when was the last time I had this? I feel pretty good. And then I typed stomach in my search, and then I could see the entries of mm-hmm. when I had mm-hmm. the stomach problem. And I do this with other things, projects and other decisions and working out or whatever it is that I want to figure, learn a little bit more about how did I behave, and that type of application I really love, because I never trust my own brain.
It's kind of interesting. Yeah, there's this entertainer in the United States. His name is Ben Gillette, and I think he's a phenomenal human being. Most people know him from him doing tricks and stuff, but I listened to one of the podcasts where he talked about journaling, and I think he's been journaling for 35 years, every single day. And he says that he feels that he started, he's 65 years old, I think, or something. And he feels he started doing it late. And he's been in it for 30, 35 years. Imagine that. But here's the interesting part. Every day when he sits down to journal, he looks what he thought on this day 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's really a great exercise.
and you know what? There is something to that. And I kind of, the problem is, here's the thing. To do this, you have to start at some point.
Yeah.
And but anyway, so yes, I think it's a great exercise. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful exercise, because you, The Day One app also has a feature where you click on and it's like same day, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, or five, if you happen to have an entry. And that sometimes I, because most of my entries, I never look at them. It's just the process that I enjoy. But sometimes I just look at the stuff that I wrote about like 3 or 4 years ago, and then I could either have the thinking like, wow, what was I thinking? Or I think, wow, I actually did what I said. And that's really a great feeling, you know?
Yeah.
So the last thing that I love to ask before we wrap up is at the end of the book, you wrote that you spent 8 months rewriting. So I love to hear how that happened for such a long time.
So there was this French impressionist, Edgar Degas. And he, when you go to Impressionist Museum and you see, when you go to Impressionist room in the museum and you see this guy painting ballet dancers, that's him. And he was a perfectionist. And it got to the point where he would paint, you know, he would paint and sell a painting, and then he would be the, visit this person's house, and he would see this painting and he would look at it intensely for 30 minutes and say, could I take it back? Could I improve it? He would take this painting and he would ruin it. Okay. So I kind of had an Edgar Degas problem on my hands a little bit, because I really cared about, again, I'm not a writing or painting on his level. But I felt like I really wanted this book to come out well. And I kept writing and rewriting. And then I realized that at some point I have to let it go. And I always wanted to pack every last ounce of my wisdom into this book. But I realized I'm still relatively young, so I can't. So at some point I have to let it go. And so, but the way I mentally convince myself is that this is volume one. I keep learning. I keep writing. I keep learning. And I may even change my mind on some of the things I wrote. And that's absolutely fine. That's what it does. It just shows growth. So I enjoyed the process. And one thing I realized, to be happy in life, really, you have to enjoy the process, as you know, in the journey. And to me, like, writing this book was such a wonderful journey, and which is now continuous, because I already, by the way, since the book came out, I wrote, aside from writing a whole bunch of articles about the war in Ukraine and other things, I wrote another 4 or 5 chapters. And, and by the way, your listeners can get them if they go to soulinthegame.net. There are instructions how after they buy the book, they can get 4, my new chapters, for absolutely free.
Yeah, I'll add and the link in the description. Yeah,
thank you. No, thank you for that. And so another thing that was kind of interesting. When the book was, I felt like 95% done, I sent it to a few dozen of my friends. And I told them, just don't spare my feelings. Just give me your feedback. Some of them gave me very positive feedback. A few of them, said, well, this chapter is out of place, this kind of things. A few of them told me, you shouldn't publish it. And one of them said, which actually made a huge difference. He said, Vitaly, I'm very confused about this book. I open it, I have no idea where to go with it. Like, I don't know, because suddenly I'm reading your biography, and then you jump to parenting, then it's kind of interesting. What's important to understand is that my innate reaction was negative. I was actually a little bit offended by this. Yeah. But then I observed that. This is where, again, kind of this observing your thoughts come in, and I thought, well, why is he feeling this way? And I realized the book to me seems so natural because I wrote it. I'm in the book. It's all, the whole book is in my head, but it's not like that for a new reader. So what it did, that comment from my friend made me write an introduction to the book that provided a roadmap, for the reader and removed some of the anxiety from somebody who picks up the book, and now they can see how the book is structured. I tell them what to expect, and which is very, very important. And then I also realized from those few people who said, yeah, I should not publish it, I know exactly the problem those people had. This book is not your typical book where there is a lot of books in this genre have this arc that go throughout the book.
May I interrupt? I think this is very, very important. I think you accomplished your goal, because as I was reading this book, I said, the feeling that I had was like, this is an honest book, right? I can sense that you mean well to other people and the reader. You like to see other people do well, and if you can play a small role in that. Well, at least this is my interpretation, right? Then that's amazing, right? And when you were just describing right now other books, I don't get a lot of feeling when I read a lot of books that they're really honest, and that doesn't have to say anything about other books. They can still be useful and you know, practical, whatever. But an honest book is something different, and I think you accomplished that.
How can I argue with that? well, no, thank you. I appreciate it. But one thing I had to become comfortable is that a book is an art, okay? And there are some structures for art creations. And a lot of times, some artists break those rules. And with this book, and some people like it, some people hate, you know, some people hate it, right? Like you live in Netherlands, and Van Gogh is from there, and he broke a whole bunch of rules, and because he broke these rules, we're still talking about him almost, you know, more than 100 years after his death. So I wasn't trying to break rules for the sake of breaking rules. I was making the best book I could do that felt right to me. And so those few folks who said I shouldn't publish it, I respected their opinion. I was not angry at them. We're still friends. You know, that nothing changed. But I realized that for some, you know, that's a, whenever you create something different, you're always going to create, you know, some, you know, you're going to have people who don't like it. And that's okay. You know, and I think at the end, the feedback, you know, if you look at feedback on Amazon, which is something I shouldn't be looking actually at, but it's a...
well, if you listen to Seth Godin, then
No, that's exactly right. You know, if you look feedback on Amazon, I think 96% of people.
I think that people really respect that it's an honest and real book. And I think what you described also is like, if you create honest art or real art, then there will always be people who maybe can't appreciate it at the time. Maybe you're ahead of your time. You know, there could be a million reasons. It doesn't really matter. What matters is that the people who do read it and love it, that counts, right?
If you think about Eiffel Tower in Paris, when it was erected at first, everybody hated it. Absolutely everybody hated it. Now it's the most beloved place in Paris.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not comparing myself to, you know, to Mr. Eiffel, but
my favorite story in that line of thinking is what I learned when I was in business school. One of my teachers said, "Remember that in the 70s or whenever they introduced the ATM, people said an ATM getting a cash out of a wall. Who does that? That's for idiots. I love to go to the counter and have eye contact with the person, and I trust them that they give me the money." And then the person or the bank or whoever it was who installed the first ATM on the dam in Amsterdam, they just went ahead and they didn't listen to the research. They installed it, and the next day there was a line from one side to the other place because people were like, "Yeah, this is amazing."
So that's exactly right. So it's a, again, I'll let readers decide it. And by the way, if you buy the book, I mean, not you, if you listen to this podcast, you buy the book, I'd love to hear your thoughts. I mean, you know, how does the book structure, you know, do you like the book structure or not? You know, what do you think about the book? I would love to get your thoughts. And, you know, if you go to Soul in a Game, there's my contact information there. So, yeah.
All right, great. So that's the best way for people to connect with you, to go to Soul in a Game?
Yeah, soulinagame.net. Also, we have by the way, the book, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably like to listen to things. So two things. First of all, this book is available on Audible as well. And also, I have a podcast, which is basically my articles read to you. And it's this podcast, you can find it on, if you just look for Intellectual Investor, or just if you go to investor.fm. And on this podcast, I talk about investing, life, classical music, you know, all these different topics. So
yeah, well, I think people listening to this podcast where I talk about investing and life and philosophy and, well, not so much classical music, but I think people can kind of relate to that type of content. So I really appreciate it. Was really a pleasure to talk to you, Vitaly. Really enjoyed the book, and hopefully readers and listeners will check it out, and maybe we'll see each other again on the next
episode. Absolutely. I really enjoyed it. Thank you, Darius. Thank you.
Take care.